My rights talk is divided into four parts. First, I want to pose two more specific problems that quickly emerge when we apply ourselves to the question of rights in light of the problems noted by people like George Will and Marianne Glendon. And secondly, I want to make some distinctions about rights that concern the two fundamental questions about them: what rights are and what explains their existence. Third, I want to look at what seems to me the key text in Aquinas on this question. And then finally, I want to suggest the lines of a Thomistic understanding of our practice of rights that I think goes a good bit towards mitigating the problems discussed by people like George Will and Marianne Glendon and others that I just mentioned. So I want to start with two quotations, and the first one I think is pretty instantly recognizable. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Now, these are, of course, the words of the Declaration of Independence. It established the United States as a nation dedicated first and foremost to the protection of fundamental rights, the fundamental rights of its people. Indeed, we can call these rights natural rights, since the Declaration refers to them not only as self-evident truths, but in the immediately preceding sentence it refers to, quote, the laws of nature and of nature's God, unquote. The fundamental basis of American government, then, seems to be natural rights. Now, consider a second quotation, one from a document produced some 216 years later. Quote, at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. Belief about these matters could not define the attributes of personhood were they formed under compulsion of the state. Does anybody know where that quotation is from?
Planned Parenthood versus Casey.
Okay, good. Excellent. So that's a 1992 Supreme Court decision called Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And in that case, the court reaffirmed the existence of a constitutional right to abortion. Now, like the Declaration of Independence, then, that decision and that quotation from the decision, which is often referred to as the mystery passage, is fundamentally concerned with rights. But the similarity ends there. The Declaration, as I said, grounds itself in the laws of nature and of nature's God, which it says are self-evident truths. The Casey Court held, or so it seems on any plain reading, that there is a fundamental right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. It's hard to know what to make of the passage, promulgated solemnly and authoritatively by our highest court, even as a matter of logic. How, for example, does one define a mystery? If one can define one's own concept of meaning, does that not pose problems for anyone else's claim to have rights? How does one person recognize the rights of another person if they have a different concept of meaning? Moreover, I have to confess that even though I make my living as a professional student of philosophy, I shudder to think of what I would do if I were required to produce my own concept of the universe. I don't have a concept of the universe. So the question here is this: what happened? What explains the transition from the Declaration of Independence's doctrine of natural rights, recognizable as self-evident truths, to Casey's right to define one's own universe? Clearly something has changed. I said that they do have one thing in common, and that they both concern fundamental rights. This common element has led some to think that the change was in some sense foreordained, that if the country was founded on a doctrine of individual rights, the transition to a kind of radical individualism, a radical individualism that leads to relativism and perhaps even to nihilism, was easy. We have arrived where we are because we began where we started. The discourse of individual rights, therefore, is the culprit. This leads me to a second problem that I want to notice. I said above that the critics of rights talk often identify it as a modern innovation. And in earlier ages and societies, political discourse was not, as it often is with us, about rights. In the ancient world, for example, there was much more talk about things like community, virtue, and duty, and very little, if any, talk about rights. So too with the medieval world, the world of St. Thomas Aquinas. Many influential historians of political and legal thought have argued that there is no doctrine of natural rights in the thought of Aquinas. Rather, Aquinas taught the doctrine of natural law. Rights are understood by modern political thinkers to be a kind of individual sovereignty, a protected zone in which the individual is free to make whatever choices she wants about some matter, a constituent element of necessarily individual freedom, and a kind of possession of individuals. Law, however, restrains one's choices, and so limits the sovereignty of the individual. Natural law is one thing, an ancient thing or a medieval thing. Natural rights are something entirely different, a modern thing. Rights are about freedom, and law is about constraint. And Aquinas on this view was very much on the constraint side. Natural rights emerge with the Enlightenment thinkers who rejected Thomistic moral and political thought. Among those Enlightenment thinkers was, most importantly for us Americans, John Locke, the English political philosopher of the 17th century. Several passages in the Declaration of Independence written by Thomas Jefferson are virtual quotations from Locke's Second Treatise on Government, which was published in 1690. And if you ever visit Jefferson's stately home, Monticello, in my home state of Virginia, you can see Locke's portrait hanging in Jefferson's living room, along with portraits of Francis Bacon and Isaac Newton, who Jefferson referred to, quote, as my trinity of the three greatest men the world has ever produced, unquote, in a letter that he wrote in 1811. Now, these two problems, I think, are closely related, since the second aims to explain the first. If postmodernism is a reaction to modernism, then the Casey decision's seemingly insouciant postmodern view of rights is a natural development out of Jefferson's modern view of rights in the Declaration, grounded as it was in the Enlightenment's rejection of Thomistic natural law. We have a very neat, if depressing, narrative here. Natural law is replaced by natural rights, which in turn yield to relativistic individualism. Now, the narrative may be true as far as it goes, although it is certainly far too simplistic. But I want to leave this issue aside in favor of what seems to me to be the more important question moving forward. Did it have to work out that way? Does the recognition of natural rights necessarily lead to individualism and perhaps relativism? And must it be at odds with natural law, as Aquinas understood it? Must we choose between natural law or natural rights? To begin to answer that question, we need to gain some clarity about just what we mean by a right and what explains the existence of rights. So this is my second part. And I want to discuss these issues in turn, but first it's necessary to make explicit a distinction that I've been assuming. I've been speaking mainly about natural rights. And those aren't the only kind of rights. By a natural right, we usually mean a right to which one is entitled simply in virtue of being a human being, a human person. Now, for Aquinas, of course, all humans are persons, although not all persons are humans. God is a person, three persons, in fact. Angels are persons. But in addition to natural rights, there are also civil or legal rights, to which persons are entitled in virtue of some specific status established by practice or law. As we all know from watching reruns of Law and Order, you have a right to an attorney if you're arrested. But that is not a natural right. It was established by the Supreme Court in a famous case called Gideon versus Wainwright from 1963. You also have a right to remain silent. But that's not a natural right either. It was established in 1966 in a case called Miranda versus Arizona. both natural and legal rights, have certain features in common, which is important in what I say about the character of rights, but they are different, and it is the differences that matter most in discussing why there are rights at all. But first things first, what is a right? The most helpful analytical account of rights was in fact produced by an American law professor, Wesley Newcomb Hofeld, who lived from 1879 to 1918. In a famous article published in the Yale Law Journal in 1913, the real genius of Hofeld's analysis was his recognition that we often use the term right to mean quite different kinds of relationships between persons. Now, this alone is significant since it led him to reject the notion, commonly accepted, that one could have a right to something, say a wristwatch, that was a relationship between you and that thing. My ownership of this watch on that view would be a function of my relationship to the watch. But Hofeld argued that there can be no legal relationship between a person and a thing, but only between a number of persons relative to something. So my legal ownership of my watch is actually a relationship between me and everyone else related to the watch. And so rights are first on this view, and this is a crucial point, relationships. They describe relationships. Relationships between persons. In fact, they are three-term relationships. Relationships between one person, one or more other persons, relative to either something, like a piece of property, or some type of action. Secondly, Hofeld distinguished four meanings that are sometimes ascribed to a right. The first he calls a claim right. And this is a right in the strongest terms, because a claim right indicates the existence of a specific correlative duty. The most common case of claim rights in law involve things like contracts. If you agree to sell me your house, then we have a certain relationship. Once I've paid the money or secured a loan from the bank, I have a claim right to the house. You have an obligation to provide it. Similarly, if you have a claim right to payment, I have an obligation to pay you. One popular way of defining a right is to argue that rights exist when there is an obligation. And this is true of claim rights, but not all rights are of this type. A second sort of right that Hofeld distinguished was what he called a liberty right. A liberty right of some kind indicates the absence of any operative claim right. I have a liberty right to knock out the wall between my kitchen and my dining room if I want to, because I own the house and I can do whatever I want to it. I did not have that right when I lived in an apartment, since the apartment complex's owners forbade such things in the lease that I signed. They had a claim right against my doing certain things to the apartment. This is a very important category of rights, since we're often said to have rights that are often really liberties and entail no obligation on anyone else's part. For example, I might have the right to speak, but you don't have an obligation to listen to me. You could have come or you could have stayed home. Now, if I had a claim right on your listening to me, then you'd have had an obligation of some sort. But that's not usually the way we think about a right to speak. A third kind of right, Hofeld called a power. And power here means the power to perform some act with legal effect, especially the sort of effect that may alter the legal position of another person. I have a power if I'm under no legal liability from another party. For example, I have a power to make a will, which could alter the legal position of my natural heirs. For example, I could leave all of my money to you rather than my children. Spouses have powers over one another's legal positions. Similarly, adults have the power to enter into binding contracts of various kinds with one another. Now, finally, there's a fourth kind of relationship that Hofeld discusses as a right, which he calls an immunity. An immunity means that one's legal position cannot be altered by the power of another person. I have, for example, an immunity from being required to testify against my wife in a criminal proceeding against her. There have never been any criminal proceedings against my wife. Some of the rights that make up the Bill of Rights appended to the United States Constitution are then really immunities. We can recognize this from the language of some of those articles. Congress shall make no law. The most important aspect of Hofeld's analysis is that it presses one to state propositions about rights with great precision, a precision that is often missing from the sorts of claims that so annoyed George Will and chagrined Ambassador Glendon. Hofeld was concerned with legal rights, not natural rights, but his analysis applies to natural rights as well. To claim that some natural right exists, one must, I think, be able to specify who holds the right, against whom, over what matters, and whether the right in question is a claim right, a liberty right, a power right, or an immunity right. Now, I want to come back to this, but first I want to say something about the more general ground of rights. Contemporary political and legal philosophers have tended to explain the existence of rights according to one of two theories. The benefit or interest theory of rights holds that rights are to be explained by reference to a benefit owed to one person, from one person to another person, or a person's interest that must be protected. This theory was most famously defended by Jeremy Bentham, the founder of utilitarianism, and has been championed most strongly by later utilitarian thinkers. The other theory is usually called the choice or will theory, and it is close to the view of rights that I discussed earlier as a kind of individual sovereignty. The choice theorists hold that rights are really powers of individuals to make certain choices for themselves, free from interference from others, and that within their protected sphere, they are indeed sovereigns. The choice theorist rejects the benefit theory because they think that that really isn't a theory of rights at all, since rights aren't doing the real work in the benefit theory, but are more like reflexes or consequences of the benefit or interest in question, which is really the primary thing. The most well-known recent choice theorist was an English legal philosopher called H.L.A. Hart, who died in 1992. Hart was, in fact, perhaps the most celebrated legal philosopher in the English-speaking world in the last half century or so. Interestingly, Hart partly changed his view of rights, which was this choice theory, on the basis of a criticism of that theory made by a Scottish legal philosopher named Neil McCormick. McCormick favored the benefit theory of rights, and he suggested a counterexample to the choice theory that Hart could not explain. Remember, the choice theory says that rights are essentially choices that individual have and that they protect those choices. And what McCormick made as a kind of argument against that theory was to raise this counterexample. What about the rights of children? Children below the age of majority have no legal powers in their own names, and therefore no, as it were, legal choices that they can make. And yet most people do seem to think that children have some legal rights. If this is so, then the rights of children simply cannot be explained by the choice theory, right? Again, those rights protect the choices of people, but children can't make legal choices. So if they have rights, they couldn't really be explained by that theory. Now, McCormick held that you could explain them by reference to the benefit theory. Hart was forced to concede the point, and so he abandoned that view of moral rights, including what were considered constitutional rights in most countries. He thought those rights then, he said, they probably cannot be explained by the choice theory, although he maintained that the most explicitly legal rights could be explained in that way. In the case of moral rights, Hart suggested that their basis could only be located in certain basic human needs. Now, both Hart and McCormick's views of rights are modern liberal views, and they are grounded in a kind of philosophical individualism. Moreover, McCormick's view, which is in many respects preferable, I think, is also tied to a kind of utilitarianism that is problematic for reasons I can't go into here. My aim in mentioning them is to show that the question of why there are any rights remains a disputed question. So I want to sketch out an alternative understanding of rights that can be developed on the basis of Thomistic philosophical principles. And that's my third part. In thinking about a Thomistic account of natural rights, we have to face up to the problem I mentioned earlier. There is no full-dress theory of individual rights in Aquinas' writings. There is no question or even article in the Summa Theologiae that spells this out. Now, this has led many to say that this is so because it is a modern notion associated with thinkers like Locke. Aquinas, the objection goes, has natural law. Locke has natural rights. Rights are individual powers. Laws are constraints. One obvious way around this is to say that natural rights are derived in some way from natural law. So, for example, Aquinas clearly thinks we have a duty to worship God. And this duty, therefore, entails the existence of a right to worship God, since, as we all know, ought implies can. You can't obligate a person to do what they can't do. I think this is true. But it doesn't get us very far. This explains a few rights, but it doesn't explain very many. Moreover, those who contrast rights and law reject the idea that the former can be derived from the latter, partly because they see rights as mainly a kind of power, the individual sovereignty that I mentioned before. And this individual sovereignty cannot be rooted in a duty because it is the opposite of a duty. One reason for the impasse here is, I think, an erroneously narrow understanding of what Aquinas meant by natural law. Natural law is one of four kinds of law that Aquinas distinguishes in the Summa Theologiae, in the so-called Prima Secundae, the first part of the second part, question 91. Now, law as such is famously defined in question 90, law as such, so what does he mean simply by law? As an ordinance of reason directed to the common good and promulgated by whoever has the care of a community. Now, it is important that ordinance, ordinatio, can mean a good bit more than simply an order or a command. It can and often does mean a kind of order in a much more abstract sense, not an order in the sense of one person orders another person to do something, but an order in the sense of an arrangement of some kind. It can and often does mean a kind of order. It is also important that punishment is no part of Aquinas' definition of law. Now, he later refers to punishment as an act of law, something that law sometimes does, but it's not part of the essential definition of law, right? An ordinance of reason directed to the common good and promulgated by whoever has the care of the community. In both of these things, Thomas's account of law is very different from modern positivist definitions of law that tend to assimilate law to commands that are accompanied by the threat of some punishment. Most of the modern positivist conception of law see laws as commands that are attached to the threat of some punishment, and neither of those elements is required by Aquinas's account of it. In question 91, Thomas tells us that there are four kinds of law. The first he calls the eternal law, and that refers to God's providential government of the whole cosmos. Now, it may seem strange to call this law, but Aquinas does so because it has the characteristics assigned to law from question 90. It is rational, because God himself is the measure of reason. It is directed to the common good, in this case, the common good of the whole created universe. It issues from the one who has the care of the community, namely God himself. And the third aspect, it has promulgation. That may seem a bit sticky here because the eternal law resides first in God's mind, to which human beings have no direct access in the present life. So how can it be promulgated? Aquinas holds that it is promulgated in three somewhat unusual ways. He mentions promulgation in the Word and the Book of Life. Now, promulgation in the Word, I take it, refers to the second person of the Trinity. Since God is three persons, there's a sense in which God promulgates the eternal law to himself. And the book of life is a reference to the biblical book Revelation, which refers to a book in which are written the names of those who are saved. So this is a reference to God's foreknowledge. Most importantly for our purposes, however, there is a third sense in which the eternal law is promulgated. Thomas calls the second kind of law natural law, and he defines it as the rational creature's participation in the eternal law. Human beings participate in God's providential government of things through their own created nature, which is distinguished by the power of free, deliberate choice. Man is the cause of his own actions. And it is precisely in this sense that human beings are an image of God. We share in God's providential government through our exercise of free will, which is directed by reason. So the eternal law is promulgated to us human beings through the nature that God gave us in creation. So the natural law then is also law in that it is an ordinance of reason. It is directed to the common good, and it's promulgated by the one who has the care of the community. It is therefore law because it shares these four elements of law. And it is natural because it is promulgated to us through our created human nature, which is a rational nature. That's the specific difference of human nature. It is a rational nature. We human beings are the causes of our own actions through our power of deliberate choice. Now, Aquinas, like Aristotle, held that every action is for the sake of some good. So those acts that we choose are chosen in pursuit of goods, and we pursue the goods that are goods for us because of the natures we have. Aquinas says in question 94, article 2, that we act for the sake of life as a good. We act for the sake of offspring as a good. Sometimes our actions are ultimately ordered towards the good of knowledge, and sometimes the good of social life itself. These are all goods that are attractive to human beings because of the natures that human beings have. And the natural law contains precepts that are related to the pursuit of these natural human goods. The natural law, then, is Aquinas' way of referring to the intelligibility of human action. It is a participation in the eternal law, because the eternal law controls all movements in the universe. The natural law is concerned with the human part and describes our movement through free, deliberate choices towards our good. Human beings pursue the natural goods through their natural abilities or powers, like thinking or moving on the basis of our own desires. Those powers work best when they are rightly disposed towards their objects. And the right disposition of those powers is what Aquinas calls the virtues. In the same question 94, he says that the natural law includes the acts that are in accordance with all of the virtues. So virtue, too, is a part of the natural law. Now, we can see on the basis of all of this that there is a rather simple synonym for natural law: morality. That's what the natural law is. It's simply a way of saying what's morally right. Now, I've gone into some detail about Thomas's understanding of the natural law because part of the challenge of thinking about natural rights from a Thomistic perspective is the opposition so commonly drawn between natural law on the one hand and natural rights on the other. Right? One is about a power that we have, rights, and the other, law, is about a constraint on our power. At least that's the usual modern view. But if by natural law Thomas really means morality in the sense that I've described it, the deliberate pursuit by human beings of their good through rational action, then I do not see how there must be any such opposition between natural law and natural rights. The view I described before holds that natural law is all about constraint and natural rights all about freedom. But this is surely wrong. The natural law for Aquinas is just as much about freedom as are natural rights. And if this is the case, then there is no inconsistency between the two and no bar to seeing the latter, the natural law, natural rights, as somehow derived from the former, natural law. If natural rights are moral rights, part of morality, then they must be part of the natural law. What else could they be? We are most accustomed to thinking about morality in terms of rules, and there are moral rules. Aquinas holds that the Ten Commandments are themselves precepts of the natural law. But virtues are also part of morality, and so part of the natural law. And so are rights, at least natural rights. Now, if what I've argued just now is correct, the natural rights are derived from the natural law, and thus ultimately from the eternal law. But I've not said anything about how natural rights can be so derived. I think that from a Thomistic perspective, we can see natural rights is derived from principles of natural law in at least two ways. One way is fairly straightforward. Life is one of the natural goods distinguished by Aquinas in question 94, article 2 of the Summa. And he says there is a natural law precept that commands us to respect human life. Later, in the second part of the second part of the Summa, Thomas holds that the intentional killing of human beings is permissible in only two cases, the killing of criminals by political authorities and the killing of enemy soldiers in a just war. The intentional killing of innocent persons is always wrong, on Aquinas' view, and therefore always forbidden. If Smith is an innocent person, then Jones has a duty to respect Smith's life, certainly not to kill him. Now remember Hofeld. The existence of a duty implies a correlate right, a claim right. If Jones has a duty to respect Smith's life, along with everybody else, so that's a generalized duty, then Smith has a right to his life. Commands can, in this way, entail rights. Aquinas also holds that reproduction and the care of offspring are natural goods for human beings. And the natural law precepts follow from this. One such precept, I think, is this. Parents have a duty to educate their children. Children, therefore, have a correlate claim right to an education, a claim right relative to their parents. Here, then, are two natural rights. Now, those who reject the derivation of natural rights from natural law won't much like this. Their response would likely be that in the examples I just gave, the real work is not being done by rights, but by duties. That rights are mere reflexes of prior obligations. Just the criticism that advocates of the choice theory of rights make against the benefit theorists that I talked about before. The force of the criticism rests on the sense in which that here the right is really just parasitic on the duty. No moral force of its own, but a kind of consequence. I'm not sure that's right, at least in these two cases. I think that circumstances may well make one take notice of the right first, and then the duty really only later. We can imagine, for example, seeing a neglected child and feeling that here is a human being deprived of what is her right, which she herself may not even know. And only later, as a consequence of that initial feeling, we might feel a kind of indignation at the failure of her parents to do their duty. But the first thing that strikes us is that this is a human being with certain basic needs that have to be filled. There is, however, another aspect of this and another worry from those who think rights cannot be derived from law. The term that we translate as right from Aquinas' Latin is the word jus, usually spelled I-U-S. Sometimes J-U-S, it's the root of the word justice, justitia. Justice for Aquinas is, first of all, the name of a virtue. And only secondarily, it can sometimes describe a state of affairs. So it's first a person has the virtue of justice, but then we can derivatively speak of a just circumstance, a circumstance in which people have fulfilled their obligations as a matter of justice. Jus is related to the word justum, which means the just thing or the just act. And this last, according to Aquinas, means the just thing, a relationship between persons. He calls it a kind of adjustment between them. And he divides jus or that relationship between person, into two kinds, what he calls jus naturale and another jus positivum. Now, the first, jus naturale, literally means natural right, although crucially here it means, again, a relationship, one that is a function of nature itself. And Aquinas gives two examples of this kind of relationship that is naturally right. One concerns a kind of equivalent value of things, like in a trade. If I give you something, you give me something that equals roughly the same thing. But the second example he gives is the relationship between parents and children. The relationship between parents and children is natural in the strict sense here, in that children literally come from the bodies of their parents in a strictly natural process, and their relationship is always a function of this. Positive right is the function of some kind of agreement, whether a private agreement or a public agreement. In between natural right and positive right is a third category, what Aquinas, following the ancient Roman lawyers, calls jus gentium, the right of nations or the right of peoples. And this is a form of right or relationship that isn't strictly natural like that of parents and children, but it follows very quickly from reason about what is natural. The main example that Aquinas gives here of jus gentium is the existence of private property rights. That individual person's own things is not naturally right because there's no natural relationship between any person and any particular thing. This is my watch, but it's not my watch because of any natural relationship between these materials and me. It's a totally conventional relationship in that sense. Property is the result of social agreement and laws. Now, the facts of human nature suggest that private ownership is the best way to arrange the distribution of property under most circumstances. So most human societies have this institution, but it is a step removed from nature itself. This suggests that there are some claim rights that individuals can make on the basis of nature, natural rights in the strongest sense, like the right to life or the right to be cared for by one's parents. There are other rights that are rather close to being natural rights, but a step removed from them and classed as rights under jus gentium, or the right of nations. For example, rights to the fruits of one's own labor in terms of a salary or something like that. Finally, there are all kinds of rights, potentially many, many kinds of rights, that are arrived at by public and private agreements, and therefore a part of positive right, not natural right. They're rights simply because we have agreed that they are rights. For example, the right to vote, the right to make contracts or wills, or the right to an attorney if you've been arrested. Now, one more wrinkle here. Remember that jus is the object of justice, the virtue of justice. Aquinas follows Aristotle in seeing different parts of the virtue of justice. He says there is one kind of justice, legal justice, that directs one's acts to the common good. There is also particular justice, which directs one's acts to specific other persons. Justice itself divided between distributive justice, which concerns the distribution from goods common to the community to individuals, and commutative justice, which directs one in one's relationship to other persons, for example, buying and selling, but also compensating one another for losses or injuries, and even the punishment of criminals. Now, the two types of particular justice are particular relative to legal justice. So even those two are related to the common good. The idea of the common good is obviously important here. It's a big topic, and I just want to say two very quick things about it. First, a common good is a good that is shareable. The good that is most common, most shareable for Aquinas, is the final universal good of the whole cosmos, which is God. But the political community itself is a kind of common good, what is sometimes called the temporal or political common good. For Thomas, of course, the temporal common good is the subject of the is subject to the universal ultimate common good, and so one's relationship to justice is subject to a good that transcends politics. For Aquinas, religio, The Latin term, which is often translated as religion, is the name of a virtue related to justice. It disposes one to give to God what is God's jus, which is worship, God's right. And this is the basis for Aquinas of the right to religious freedom. So, to conclude then, I want to admit to you that the modern rights theorist is probably not going to be persuaded by what I've just said, for a reason that you may well have anticipated. If a right is a kind of individual sovereignty, a zone of freedom in which one's choices are entirely a function of one's will, then the Thomistic account of natural rights that I have suggested is not an account of rights in this sense. It is, a modern theorist would say, an account of right, maybe in the singular, which is not a protected zone of individual sovereignty, but a kind of objective relationship between persons, one in which duties and the common good play a major role. Nothing that I have said will convince him otherwise, nor in a sense should it. In the end, there is a divide between the Thomistic account that I've given, and which I think is true, and the modern understanding of rights, one that goes right back to Thomas Jefferson and his trinity of Bacon, Newton, and Locke. This was not Aquinas' trinity. For Aquinas, natural right and natural law are ways in which we are ordered to our final ends, to the universal common good that is God. For Jefferson and his successors, not least the judges who signed on to the majority opinion in the Casey decision, we are our own ends, and thus our own sovereigns, sovereign individuals who must get along together. There's no getting around this difference. But, and this is my final point, when we think of the most important human rights that Aquinas would call natural rights, rights like the right to life, to the care and upbringing of parents, the right not to be tortured, or to worship freely, we think of ways in which those rights are protected by the institutions and practices of modern political and legal systems. Institutions are often related to theories, but they are not the same thing as theories. And the same institutions can be upheld and maintained on the basis of more than one theoretical account. I think that modern theories of rights as individual sovereignty of persons who are their own ends is mistaken, and often leads to just the problems with which I began. But unlike some of those who have noted these problems, I do not believe that the remedy is to repudiate the notion of natural or human rights. The protections that they afford human persons against the terrible power of modern states is too important. The remedy is to explain them and improve them on the basis of a better theory. St. Thomas Aquinas did not produce a theory of human rights, but his moral and political thought contain the materials out of which a better theory can be constructed, and I've tried to sketch a way in which you could do that this evening. Thank you.
We're going to have some time for Q&A if you want to ask the professor any questions.
I'm not familiar. I'm not as familiar with the Thomistic thought. So thanks a lot, Professor. I did have a question. What did he think about other people's ideas about God, right? So he thinks that you have a right or a duty to God to worship. And wasn't his conception, was it Christian, with Platonic ideas with it, but was what that idea of what God meant? I mean, would that extend to other people's ideas of what God was? Or how did that go?
Right. So obviously Aquinas is a Christian theologian. He's a medieval Christian theologian, so he has a totally orthodox Christian view of these things. So what does he think about other religions and so forth relative to, for example, the duty to worship God? Well, he thinks the duty to worship God in and of itself, which is a function of this virtue he calls religio, which is part of the virtue of justice, that's a natural virtue. So in other words, he doesn't get his notion that we owe God anything from something provided by revelation from the Bible or something like that. He thinks this is something that you can know on the basis of natural reason. Now, what the specific form of one's obligation to worship is, right? What you have to do in order to satisfy that duty is something that doesn't come from natural religion, but is usually supplied by a particular religious tradition. And even though Aquinas believes in the Christian faith, he asks in one question, I mean, there are two questions that are kind of relevant to this. One is that is it fair, is it right to compel a person to accept the Christian faith? Say, a person who's never been a Christian, a person who's from some other religious tradition. And the answer to that question is no. Because to accept the Christian faith, it has to be a free act, or it doesn't mean anything. Now, a person who's already accepted the Christian faith, he thinks they can be compelled to sort of honor their obligations that they've undertaken. But if a person who's never accepted it, he says, has to be free in that sense. But there's also another question that's rather interesting in the Summa. At one point, and he asked this because this was a practical problem at the time that he lived. Evidently, there were some people who went around, for example, in some cities in Europe where there were Jewish populations, kind of surreptitiously baptizing Jewish children. Now, if you're a Christian, baptism is obviously very important. And certainly some of these people thought they were doing a great thing by baptizing these children, but they were doing it against the wishes of their parents to children who were not part of their religious tradition. So Aquinas specifically asked the question at one point in the Summa, is it right to baptize Jewish children against the will of their parents? And his answer to that question is no, it's wrong. It's wrong because it violates the natural right of the parents to care for their children. So there, in two senses, you've got some sense of Aquinas' views about religious freedom relative to non-Christian religious traditions.
Well, doesn't he also say, in that said, in the very same Second contra, that the reason why we don't do that is precisely because the parents forfeit their rights, and because those children are now Christian, we have, or the church has an obligation to take care of those kids and actually separate them from their parents. This seems to be the reasoning behind, you know, the famous Sportara case under Pius the Ninth, so that once someone becomes a Christian, the obligations of the church to these Christian children, like this becomes an edge case in which natural law, or the original natural right of the parents, can get overtaken by the church.
Well, I think that's a more controverted issue. I don't know that there's anything that Aquinas that would simply support what was done in that case.
It's quite explicit in the Sed Contra, which, you know, as we know in a Thomistic article, this is the place where he argues from authority and says why all the previous objections are incorrect. So at least in the Mortara case is a very edge case. But
is a what?
Is a very edge case, and that's why it's used so effectively by anti-Catholic Aquinasists against the church. However, I think putting that in the Sed Contra actually shows Aquinas' consistency in that law is correctly ordered to the common good and beyond that to God himself.
Yeah, I mean, there are more difficult parts of some of the things that Aquinas says about, again, what we would consider to be religious freedom. I mean, so while he says that it's wrong to coerce a person who's not a Christian into the Christian faith, he thinks you can coerce a person who's already in it. I mean, that's
exactly right.
I mean, and with heretics and so forth, too. And that's a much tougher thing. And in fact, there the church teaches something quite different than what he says in those places. But that's a particular issue.
Yeah. Also, I appreciate the discussion of use, because obviously in secondary literature on Thomas, this whole debate about how the medievals or the ancients didn't have a word for right, and it's good to kind of flesh this out and how we can derive an idea of rights using medieval language. I think what also would have been more helpful in understanding natural rights is actually the treatment of the word natural, which tends to have a very vague consideration among us, but it seems to be, at least as Thomas uses it, a technical Aristotelian term referring to the natures of created things in reference to formal and final cause. And once this paradigm of natures as a thing by formal or final cause is ordered to a certain end or ordered to actualize a certain form and not something else, once this conceptual framework is kind of established, then it's easier to argue to say how rights or law is ultimately ordered to the common good as against the early modern conception of individual rights.
Yeah, no, he certainly is operating with Aristotle's conception of nature there. And the business about use, I mean, I think that's important in part because it is a view that many people have, for example, that there's just no notion of anything like an individual right prior to modern times. And there have been debates about this among scholars. And, you know, some historians of this, I think, have shown pretty decisively that certainly in Aquinas you can find specific passages where the only way to understand what he's saying is that he's talking about a kind of individual right. Now, there's no kind of theoretical teaching about that. I mean, there's no question where he says, now I'm going to talk about natural rights, and he spells it all out. But some specific things he talks about clearly are what we would call an individual right. So they're there, and he uses that term jus in a kind of individual subjective way in various places. But where there's far more evidence of this is, in fact, not so much Aquinas as medieval canon law, where, I mean, it's just clear that this conception is there, it's operating. It's not discussed in the way that we discuss it, and it's not discussed nearly as much as we discuss it, but it's there. So it's simply not true to say that there were no individual rights prior to the 17th century or something like this. But what's important is the larger context of that account, which is related to nature, as you say. So, yeah.
Good day, Professor. Whose rights are protectable these days? Technology-wise, we look at so many aspects of strength, of character. We call these the virtues. Who's protectable these days for privy technological rights?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
For example, companies use information. We house data centers. We look at ways to build the church and protect our consumers.
I see.
So how might you say Thomas Aquinas would, the gentleman, have dealt with them back in the day?
Well, most of those kind of things, it seemed to me, I mean, I'd have to think about it a little more, but I wouldn't think you'd be talking about natural rights in most of those cases. I mean, you'd be talking about protections that we think should be instituted as legal rights. Some of them may be related to natural rights in some ways. I mean, when you're talking about personal data that can impinge on the relationships between parents and children, for example, and this sort of thing. But most of those issues, I gather, would simply be issues of legal rights. And so those things, legislators sort out using political prudence in order to achieve what's in the best interest of the community and so forth. And it may be that natural rights form a kind of limit there, but the specific content of rights that would have to do with things like that, I would think, would mostly be legal rights.
Through protectable consumers, we sign legal agreements.
Right.
And we look at who's looking at who, so to say. The church talks of brothers. We talk of Big Brother in another scope of an Orwell sense. And do we think that then the side opposite the side, for example, the hourglass looking at us from a morbid reflection might taint the likeness of God, our Creator. So how do we protect ourselves in the common sense? How would you protect yourself in the common sense to in the technology field?
Well, I mean, people make their decisions about how much of this they're going to enter into, but I, as a public matter, it seems to me, you know, we protect individuals as, again, legally, as consumers and as members of certain communities. There are things companies can't do to you. There are things the university can't do to you. There are things other people can't do to you, and there's no reason those can't be extended to, you know, technology of various kinds, which is mostly in the hands of associations or corporations or things like that. I don't know that that's fundamentally different from the regulation of any other relationships legally that we have. Maybe that it's not being adequately done, and you make a case that we should do it differently and that more protection is required, but that's what the issue would be, I think. A legislative question. Yeah.
So are things like, so it sounded from what you were saying that it could be seen that like possessions in general don't fall under natural rights. So like for instance, if I like find, you know, like a bunch of money, like in a context, like a very abstract context, do I not, I don't have any like inherent right to keep it. Like the only right that I would have to keep anything that I found is that other people agree that I can keep it, basically.
Yeah, right? Yeah, that's right. I mean, in natural right in the strict sense doesn't include private property. And why is that? Because on Aquinas' view, right, when God made the world, he made it for human beings so that they could have what they needed in order to live. And there was no assignment of any particular thing in the world to any particular person. Now, there are strictly natural relationships between certain persons, like parents and children. But there's no natural relationship between any person and anything. Now, human beings need to use things in order to live, so human beings have a right, Aquinas says it's a right to use things. But insofar as those things are considered the property of a person, that's not a natural relationship. It's something that's settled through agreement by the society, by the political community. And Aquinas, following Aristotle, says that because you can make certain generalizations about human nature, right? He says people tend not to care for things that they don't own, and that people tend to quarrel about things that are owned in common and so forth. So there are certain robust generalizations, you might say, about human nature that lead him to say property should be held in private. And that's rational, so it certainly is consistent with what's naturally right, but it's not natural right in the strict sense. That's why he has this sort of intermediate category, which he calls jus gentium, because in human societies, this is the way it's done. So it's not unnatural, but it's not natural in the strictest sense of the term. It's a derivative conclusion from nature, which is a function of human decisions. And it could be done in a different way, for example. You know, in a natural disaster, it might be that the only way to protect life and so forth is, in fact, for some kind of common distribution of property or something like that, maybe temporarily or something like that. So ordinarily speaking, private possession is the best way to go, but that's not simply established by nature so it can be changed. I mean, that's his view.
So what about a situation where, like you know, you have a natural right to exist, to live, to keep living. And to do that, for instance, you need food. So like what if, you know, you're in a situation where a person doesn't have any means of getting food. Other people, like there might be food available, but like it might belong to other people. And so in that sense, society has determined that these other people have a right to it. Do you still have would that be a natural right? Would you have a natural right then to take the food that you need to survive, even though it's against the rights that the society has?
Aquinas says yes. He's in the question where he treats the issue of property and gives the sort of account that I just gave. In one of the articles, he says, is theft a sin in cases of necessity? And his answer is, if it really is a case of necessity, it's not theft. Right? Because again, the primitive relationship between human beings and things is that God made the world for human beings
so that they could use the things that they need to live, but he didn't assign any particular thing to any particular person. And now the best way to do that generally is to make those assignments, but again, if it's a case of genuine necessity where a person simply doesn't have what they need to survive, you revert back to the original situation. It's almost as if the basic rule here is that things are for people. Now, ordinarily, the best way to sort of put things and people together is some arrangement of property rights. But again, in a case of genuine necessity, we revert back to the primitive principle, and Aquinas says the person under that circumstance has a right to what they need. And so it's not theft. He says it's not theft because they have a right to it. Yeah.
So it's not entirely clear to me how the proposal we made at the end of the talk about how Thomists could kind of reconcile themselves to modern rights-based political institutions, like how that would work in practice. Because I guess the proposal, so you said that Thomists should place modern rights-based institutions on a firmer foundation by trying to persuade people to adopt a Thomistic theory of natural rights. And I guess it seems to presuppose the proposal that the Thomists and modern rights theorists are in some sense trying to achieve the same thing, to constrain the power of the state, and modern rights theorists justify it in a certain defective way, and Thomists have a better justification. But I'm not sure that's true. Like, even if you just look at the Declaration of Independence, the famous opening lines that you quoted, the foundation is that, like, people, individuals, have rights just to certain forms of activity that are valuable for them. And the reason it's bad for them to be constrained by the state is not that the state is dangerous inherently, but that, like, they're doing what they want is good inherently. And it seems like, and that certainly seems to be how people think about it in our political culture, and with people, many people who are rhetorically very strongly committed to individual rights are happy to, like, use the power of the state to oppress people when they think that it's necessary to secure, like, individual sovereignty, like, in terms of a contemporary examples of how people who bring, like, seek religious liberty exemptions to anti-discrimination laws are treated. So, yeah, I guess I'm not sure. It doesn't seem like there's enough common ground for that proposal to work. So I'm curious how you
do this. That's a serious question. I mean, I take it what you're saying is essentially, if my argument is that we can give a better Thomistic theory of the practice of human rights, that there still are going to be certain sort of on the ground issues where
it's not just that. So it plays out in certain concrete contexts, but I think it reflects, like, a deeper foundational disagreement about, like, why rights-based institutions are worth preserving.
Yeah. Well, I don't dispute that. In fact, I think I sort of admitted that. I said I wouldn't expect a lot of people to be convinced, at least initially, by the reconciliation that I'm suggesting. And, you know, what is it today? This is 2018. So in December, it will be the 70th, is that right? 70th anniversary of the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948. And, you know, there's a famous Thomistic part of that story. There was a committee of intellectuals and philosophers, in some cases philosophers, who were working through UNESCO to advise the people drafting the Universal Declaration. And among those was a philosopher, a French philosopher named Jacques Maritain, who was a Thomist. And in fact, Mary Tan was in charge of one of these kind of working groups. And he famously said at one point, he was asked by somebody, gee, how can you people with such very different views agree in practice on this list of human rights? And Mary Tan's kind of famously responded, yeah, we can all agree on what rights we have as long as nobody asks us why. And he thought you could get this practical agreement on a list of rights, and that's, of course, what the Declaration is, right? It's a long list of rights. But he understood you wouldn't get agreement on why those rights. And it's always seemed to me that in giving that answer, Mary Tan was somewhat optimistic, and also that given things that have happened since that time, it might be that you couldn't say the same thing today. That the disagreements would be far more serious, and in part for precisely the reason that you gave. And so I think that's a real question, and it's going to manifest itself with respect to certain specific issues, like the issues involving religious liberty that you mentioned. And what that brings up is this problem that we always face that goes under the name of pluralism, or kind of deep moral disagreement among people. And I mean, that's just a fact. I mean, it's in a certain respect, it's like the weather. I mean, there is this pluralism. It's not going away anytime soon. And it seems to me, under those circumstances, the only way that we can continue to live together is to try to find what grounds that we can in common, and to keep arguing, and to keep arguing. And that's that. There's no kind of silver bullet to eliminate those disagreements, and there certainly will be areas where you can't paper them over, and it's going to go on. And as I say, Mary Tan may have been a bit optimistic in what he said, but I don't see any alternative to that project. And from a Thomistic perspective, clearly there are aspects of the modern rights theory that I talked about that are a real problem, that again, somebody who's a Thomist simply can't accept. Now, I know from the side of kind of modern rights theorists that I'm going to accept parts of the Thomistic account. So the only thing we can do is give the best account of the theory that we can and hope to communicate with people. But I also think the issue of the state is particularly important, though, because that's one of the reasons that rights are as important as they are. The modern state, in particular, is a political form that is capable of oppression in a way that political communities were not for most of human history. And that's a very important reason all by itself to find a way to explain and to defend the existence of human rights, I think. But it's a very serious question, I don't deny that.
I was wondering if you could comment on one specific sort of type of scenario in which the religious view of rights and the secular view of rights tend to often come apart. And I guess it's probably the easiest way to give an example. Like, for example, the body, for example. From a secular perspective, if I have sovereignty over my body, I have right to the integrity of my body, that means that other people can't harm me in certain ways. But I think the religious understanding, from the religious understanding would also follow that I cannot harm my own body in certain ways. And I think this results from a recognition that ultimately sovereignty belongs solely to God, and our rights are sort of lent to us by Him. So rather than having an ultimate sovereignty over whatever we have a right to, is there any way of reconciling this sort of difference?
Well, I mean, in practice, it may well be that you can get a certain distance there. I mean, you know, when you talk about medical ethics, right, and the fact that, you know, even in most states, right, I mean, to inflict medical procedures on a patient who doesn't want them, I mean, it could be considered battery. I mean, in some cases, there's criminal liability there. But for quite different reasons, in you know, on a sort of Thomistic view on the one hand versus a secular view on the other.
But in the end, and I tried to sort of acknowledge this at the end of the talk, there is a certain gap there that simply can't be overcome. There's no sovereignty for a Thomist other than God's sovereignty. And anything that claims to be sovereignty is derivative from that. So just one kind of example of this. You know, in the 19th century, there were a lot of popes, and even into the early 20th century, who made statements in papal encyclicals and so forth that seemed to condemn democracy. So Pius IX, for example, some later popes. But once you sort of get into the 1940s, I mean, there's bits of this earlier, but really starting in the 1940s and then certainly on into through the Second Vatican Council, you start to get statements where it's not only the case that democracy is not condemned, but it's even sort of endorsed, right? And at one level, that looks like a change. But at a deeper level, it's not a change, because if you look with some precision at what some of these 19th century popes and even early 20th century popes were rejecting, it wasn't democracy understood, for example, as elections, the rule of law, you know, limited government, something like that. It was democracy understood as the view that political power comes from the will of the people. And they denied that because they denied that power came from anywhere other than God, ultimately. And there is a school of interpretation of Aquinas, for example, that dates back to the 16th century, that holds that the power ultimately comes from God and it devolves into the community. God has transmitted it in some way to the political community that then determines how it will be exercised through choice of a form of government, choice of leaders, etc. But that political authority is always derivative from God's authority in the end. And that's because certainly there are texts in Scripture and so forth, Romans 13, it's very clear, all power comes from God, all authority comes from God. So there's got to be a way to explain how it comes from God and somehow makes its way into political institutions. And there's a theory about that. And that entails the rejection of the notion that people are their own ends and the source of their own sovereignty. So there can't be any endorsement of sovereignty as anything other than divine power that's somehow mediated or derived into human authority. And there's no getting around that. There's no getting around that. So that remains a kind of fundamental disagreement. Now, that doesn't mean you can't agree on lots of practical stuff, but there will be cases, even practical cases, where you run into that issue, and then it's much more difficult. Again, I don't think it does anybody any good to sort of act like that's not the case, because it is in some ways. But again, I think it's important in a liberal society understood in the sense, when I say liberal, I mean with the limited government that protects human rights and so forth. You can't have that under the conditions we live in without an array of accommodations and forbearance among people over precisely these differences, and that's what we're trying to work out in a messy process. But there's no alternative to it.
Thank you again, Professor Lewis, for speaking with us this evening. We have one more round of applause.